Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how worried should we be about the animosity between the U.S. and Iran? We'll spend this hour talking with Middle East security scholar Ilan Goldenberg, talking about what's happened since President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, including Iranian attacks on Saudi oil fields and American military facilities in Iraq, and the U.S. airstrike that killed Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani. We'll talk about the options available to both sides for resolving the crisis without further bloodshed, and about what a full-out war between the U.S. and Iran might look like if it were to come to that. Our conversation starts after a short break. And Iran have anything in common right now, it's that leaders in both countries are on high alert for the next act of violence, and their citizens are on edge. Can the current wave of tit-for-tat aggression be resolved peacefully, or will it escalate into a full-scale war? And is there a danger that such fighting could pull the entire Middle East region into chaos? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In a televised address Wednesday, President Trump said Iran appears to be standing down and announced a new round of sanctions, but called for diplomatic talks. That made some observers hopeful that cooler heads might prevail. But then this morning, the commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said the U.S. could soon expect harsher revenge, that's a quote, for the killing of General Qasem Soleimani. We wanted to understand the real stakes here and the options available to both sides to either soothe or exacerbate the cycle of violence. And we've invited Ilan Goldenberg to help with that. He is senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Ilan, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, Iran carried out pretty surgical strikes on U.S. military targets within Iraq this week as a retaliation for the Soleimani killing. What can we read into how those attacks were orchestrated?
Look, what the Iranians were trying to do was, you know, obviously the Soleimani killing was huge for them domestically. We're talking about one of the most important people in Iran. We're talking about massive funeral that happened afterwards. And so they felt the need. They needed to respond, and they needed to respond publicly, at least at first. But they also didn't want to trigger a conflict with the United States, at least a direct conflict with the United States, an all-out war, because in that scenario, they know that they lose. And so, but they wanted, it had to be public and it had to be significant. So what they did was launch a series of ballistic missiles at American bases in Iraq. And this was significant in that this is the first time anybody, any country has launched, you know, and acknowledged launching missiles at American bases, I believe since 2003, since the Iraq War, where Saddam Hussein might have launched some, I think, launched some missiles at American bases in the Gulf. But it's really been that long. So it was significant, but at the same time, kind of going out of their way to ensure that there were no major casualties. It sounds like there's varying press reporting, but they told the Iraqi prime minister in advance. There seemed to have been other indicators. I really think that they were looking for something that was big and symbolic as a first response, but did not actually escalate. And then their public messaging that evening, at least to an American audience and to the world, was, you know, we are taking these strikes. Do not respond. Regions, stay out of this. It sounded very de-escalatory from the start, where at the same time, in terms of an Iranian public television, they were going off about large numbers of Americans killed and making this a much bigger deal than it actually was for their domestic audience. So I think that was the initial response, but the real question is what comes next.
We've heard reporting that Soleimani was something of a cult hero within Iran. How widely known was he at home before he was killed? And are Iranians outraged because of who he was specifically or simply to the extent that he sort of represents the entire country?
Well, it's complicated. So Qasem Soleimani has been the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force for a long time, 20 years. The Quds Force is the force that works to support various militia groups and really drives Iran's foreign policy in Lebanon, where it works with Hezbollah, in Iraq, where it works with various Shia militia groups, in Syria, where it supported Bashar al-Assad. You know, in Iran, he wasn't really a household name until, he was a bit of a household name, but not this kind of hero until 2014, when he really led the counter-ISIS fight and is seen by many Iranians as the man who saved them from ISIS. On the other hand, he's also absolutely seen as a tool of repression by the state. And so he's not universally beloved necessarily amongst all Iranians. And he's certainly actually detested by a large number of Arabs in the Middle East who see him as a vehicle for, sectarian violence and, Iranian interference in their affairs. And obviously seen by us as a man who was responsible for the deaths of 600 Americans in Iraq. So a complicated view of him, but I think where the outrage came from is he was a national hero to many, but also I think for Iranians, the concept that the United States would assassinate one of their top leaders in and of itself was kind of an outrageous thing. So, I think part of it is about that. Part of it is the fear of a war with the United States. And part of it was his popularity. I think it was kind of all the above that sort of mixed together to create this outpouring.
So as head of the Quds Force, is that equivalent to, say, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff being murdered abroad by some adversary of the United States? Help me understand sort of his rank as it relates to governance in Iran.
Probably more, maybe I'll get a little weedy here, but probably more like the most significant, like, overseas commander or COCOM commander, like this, our CENTCOM commander, maybe the chairman, but there is actually a head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps who, technically outranks him. But he was so important and had such a personal relationship with also with Ali Khamenei, the head of, Iran, the supreme leader, that, from a sort of domestic political consumption and like where he stood in the system, you'd have to argue he was probably the second or third, probably the most important person in the country after the supreme leader and maybe the president, Hassan Rouhani, but in that category. So, yes, a very big deal.
To step back for a minute here, you mentioned that Soleimani has been acknowledged by Americans sort of across the political spectrum as being responsible for the deaths abroad of 600 Americans approximately. What do we need to know about the direct threat he posed to Americans and U.S. interests in the recent past?
So, the 600 happened really between 2003 and 2011 when we were in Iraq, and he was really spearheading an effort to arm militia groups that were going after our soldiers. In the near proximate events around what has just happened, what we really had is, a year and a half ago, I'll run through this very quickly, but a year and a half ago, President Trump leaves the Iran nuclear deal. For a year afterwards, and Iran basically stays in the agreement and sort of tries to get the other parties to the agreement, China, Russia, and some of our European partners, to give them the economic benefits that they had expected from the deal, in exchange for constraining their nuclear program. It didn't really work because these countries couldn't provide the economic benefits without losing access to the American market. So about 6 months ago, Iran starts to escalate. These escalations involve a missile strike on Saudi oil facilities in September, and before that, a couple of mining attacks on shipping in the Gulf. And part of it was also increasing rocket attacks on American forces inside Iraq being conducted by Shia militia groups associated with Iran, really directed by Qasem Soleimani in many ways. And so, one of those rocket attacks kills an American contractor about 2 weeks ago at this point, December 27th. The next day, the United States decides to respond by taking out a number of these facilities from that Shia militia group, Kitab Hezbollah, killing 25 fighters and taking out five facilities. Then, in response to that, you have these protests next to an American embassy, basically overrunning parts of the American embassy the next day, which then triggered a decision by the United States and President Trump, it sounds like, to take out Qasem Soleimani. It's an open question about whether or not there was a direct and imminent threat. The administration is claiming that there was an imminent threat, a major attack that was being planned, but they refused to share any information with anybody about what that imminent threat was. Which makes people quite suspicious. It's one thing to not share it with the press. Obviously some of this intelligence could be very sensitive, but to not share it with anyone in Congress, including members of the intelligence committees and some of the leadership who are usually notified of these types of operations and even the most sensitive intelligence, and to not share it with them is highly problematic unless it doesn't exist, which I think a lot of people think at this point is the case. My view, I'm increasingly suspicious of the fact that basically the president decided he wanted to do this because he was angry about the embassy bombing or the embassy protests. And now they're trying to justify it by saying it was imminent, but there really does not seem to be anything all that imminent. And all the press reporting has been that, you know, from intelligence officials inside the government, there's been a lot of press reporting saying that the intelligence has been inflated.
So if we can, at the very least, stipulate that from the U.S. perspective, he was a dangerous guy, kind of detrimental to U.S. interests. He does have a successor, right? There's this guy, Ismail Khani, the general who stepped up to replace him as head of the Quds Force. One would assume that Khani, even before the death of Soleimani, was sort of briefed on whatever plans Soleimani planned to carry out.
Yeah, I mean, he's been Soleimani's deputy for 20 years. He knows very well what's going on. And this is the other sort of question that comes in when you're thinking about imminence of the threat, which is, you know, a guy at Soleimani's rank is not planning the logistical details of a strike. He might be involved, but it's not like if he is killed, that threat goes away. If anything, the likelihood of a retaliation goes up. So the likelihood of a plot like that being carried out is actually higher in the aftermath of his killing than before it.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to listen to what President Trump had to say yesterday in his news conference.
The United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior. In recent months alone, Iran has seized ships in international waters, fired an unprovoked strike on Saudi Arabia, and shot down two U.S. drones. Iran's hostilities substantially increased after the foolish Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2013, and they were given $150 billion, not to mention $1.8 billion in cash. Instead of saying thank you to the United States, they chanted death to America. In fact, they chanted death to America the day the agreement was signed.
Can you explain the president's contention that the Iranians were given billions in cash?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, the number is much closer to $50 billion than $150 billion in terms of the economic benefits that they got out of the nuclear agreement. A lot of that was their own money that was actually being held up through sanctions in foreign reserve, basically foreign reserve accounts, because basically part of the sanctions that had been applied made it impossible to actually bring that money back into the country, even if they conducted legitimate trade. But the bigger issue was, you know, and the bigger problem with what the president said is that, like, look, we did this nuclear deal. The point of the nuclear deal was to contain the nuclear program, make it impossible for Iran to get a nuclear weapon, which is what it did, in exchange for sanctions relief, which are sanctions that we had applied on Iran because of its violations of, you know, of the NPT and some of its cheating on the nuclear question. And so, you know, the situation was basically under control. We had bought a lot of time. We were can be able to continue to engage with them on other issues until the president chose to walk away from the deal in May of 2018. And that's what's then caused all of these escalatory steps that have come since. You know, he talked about, you know, like the naval attacks. He talked about the attacks on Saudi facilities. I mean, basically, all of those things were steps taken by Iran after a year of staying in the deal to try to signal to the United States and to the rest of the world that, look, you can't keep applying pressure on us and squeezing us with zero costs for you. We're not just going to continue to abide by this nuclear agreement if you do that. And so that's what's caused us to get to where we are today. I mean, the other thing I'll say about this is there's really very little evidence. Like, Iran was doing a lot of terrible things in the region or things that were against our interests in the region before 2015 in the nuclear deal. And it kept doing those things after 2015. And the reality is it's also pretty cheap to do the kinds of things that they generally tend to do. So I don't really think that all the money that came out of the nuclear deal necessarily changed the regional dynamic the way the president claims it did.
My guest is Alon Goldenberg, senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We're talking this hour about the U.S., Iran, and what comes next. This is Think. I'm Chris we're talking about the situation between the U.S. and Iran with Ilan Goldenberg, senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for New American Security. Here is the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, speaking for the first time about Soleimani's killing and the missile attacks carried out by Iran.
When it comes to confrontation, military actions of this kind are not enough. What is important is the presence, that the corrupt presence of the United States in this region should come to an end.
All right. I want to ask, what kind of pressure exists on Khamenei right now, Ilan Goldenberg, and are they different than the pressures that are facing Iranian President Hassan Rouhani? They have powerful roles. Many people would say the supreme leader is much more powerful than the president, but are there different roles causing them to behave in different ways at this moment?
Well, I actually think right now they're probably pretty well aligned. They kind of have to be. But they are, what is happening now is, you know, Iran did its initial very public response. And I think what they're probably considering now is, well, what to do next. And I'm sure that the retaliation is not entirely over and that there's a lot of debate going on inside of Iran about what to do. My guess would be that given their history and given the type of strike that we conducted, they'd be thinking about things like a terrorist attack on American target in the Middle East or an assassination attempt on a senior American official, probably again in the Middle East, cyber attacks, other proxy attacks, missiles. There's have a whole bunch of things they could do, but what they'd want to do is try to find something that was relatively deniable and so that it wouldn't necessarily trigger a major American response. But I really think what we've only seen so far is the symbolic public response, but not yet the real response, which they're going to try to pull off. But it's very hard for them to pull off. We're talking about, you know, something very complicated to try to do, and if to be on the equal level as Soleimani, but at the same time not trigger an all-out American retaliation, that's a complicated sort of thing for the needle for them to try and thread. I do think that, you know, Supreme Leader Khamenei and you know, President Rouhani do see things a little bit differently. You know, I think Rouhani is a little bit more, you know, pragmatic. He understands the American system better. He understands the West better. He cares more about international engagement, more about the potential economic benefits for the United States, and is probably less willing to push the envelope. Khamenei, he's not exactly a hardliner, but he kind of falls more in on that side, generally speaking, though his governing style is this kind of, you know, importantly, I think to remember is he's the ultimate decision maker. Mm-hmm. The president is just one of a number of people speaking in Khamenei's ear, and Khamenei tries to stay above politics and basically hear all these different decision makers and then make some kind of decision based on that, usually going with where the majority is or where things seem to be going. So, but his general disposition towards the United States and the West is, I think, much more negative than Khamenei, than Rouhani's necessarily. He barely ever, I think it's been 30 years since he's left Iran. So he just doesn't understand us the way a guy like Rouhani might. But they are both men of the same system. I'm not trying to, you know, I mean, there are, even those who are more on the reformist side on the Iranian political spectrum, if they're part of the accepted political spectrum, they're part of the Islamic Republic. So they're not too far outside the stream. But there are debates like this that happen amongst them.
Yeah. What can you tell us? What can you speculate about the kinds of back channel conversations that might be happening directly between U.S. and Iranian representatives right now?
Right now, not a lot, would be my guess, other than passing messages to de-escalate. You know, the president has said, well, one thing that's interesting is, you know, Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif was supposed to come to New York to a Security Council meeting next week. And usually that's something that even, you know, the United States is not supposed to, as part of the agreement of putting the United Nations in New York, was that the United States will not deny visas to anyone coming for a meeting like that. But we chose to deny him a visa, which I think was a major mistake because that would have been an opportunity to send somebody down to talk to him. And actually, Rand Paul, you know, member, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who is actually quite close with President Trump, but at the same time is also very much in the anti-war camp, has gone and done previous meetings with Zarif before in New York and acted as a go-between. So that could have been a useful opportunity to do that. You know, and maybe we're trying through the Europe. We have a channel through the formal channels through the Swiss embassy in Tehran, that technically the Swiss represent our interests in Iran. So formal messages have been going back and forth over the last few days between Iran and the United States through the Swiss, from my understanding. But, you know, other than that, it's pretty hard to establish channels. Unfortunately, the best channel we've had is actually through Oman and the Sultan of Oman, who had a very direct channel to the Supreme Leader, and the IRGC was part of the key to getting the nuclear deal in the first place. But unfortunately, he is very ill and, you know, by some reports on, you know, near death. And so he's not able to play that role anymore, which is actually would be a vital role to have right now.
Ilan, what exactly does Iran want in the wake of the collapse of the JCPOA? Should we assume that any current nuclear development is, in fact, in service to nuclear weapons capability, or as Iran maintains, that it's only pursuing peaceful technologies like energy development?
So Iran has had a strategy, a long-term nuclear strategy, of building out the option to build a nuclear weapon while not necessarily making a decision to do so. And they've been doing that for like the last 25 years. And what they've started doing now is rebuilding their nuclear program as they've violated slowly elements of the JCPOA. But you can tell by the way they're doing it slowly and on purpose. You know, what they really want is the sanctions relief. And I think at this point they'd be happy to give up and go back to where they were and abide by the JCPOA if they were to get the sanctions relief. They want the relief of economic pressure, which is squeezing the country. And they view the nuclear program as their one of their strongest pieces of leverage in any negotiation with the United States and the other world powers.
Like so, North Korea. Excuse me for interrupting you.
Sure. Yeah.
Sort of a similar strategy as North Korea, many people think, has developed its nuclear capability in part as a way to have leverage.
Yes. I mean, the only difference is Iran is far short of where North Korea was mm-hmm. in terms of its actual nuclear weapons capability, because North Korea has nuclear weapons. Part of the reason North Korea has nuclear weapons is North Korea had all these missiles basically pointed at Seoul, which is very close by, a city of millions of people. And North Korea had the capacity without nuclear weapons to essentially destroy Seoul and cause major damage and carnage in any conflict between that involved North Korea. And so they used that conventional deterrent to stop an attack and deter an attack on them as they were building out their nuclear weapon. Iran doesn't have that kind of conventional deterrent. And so therefore, I think it's harder to see the Iranians putting aside the civil sort of all checks on the system and going for a nuclear weapon because they would be more vulnerable to attack. This is the problem that they have. They want the option, but when you really go for it, you leave yourself open. You leave yourself in a period where you don't have it yet and everybody knows you're going for it. And us or the Israelis at that point might strike at them.
So what if Iran were to develop a fully functional nuclear weapon and the missile technology to deliver it, how would that change the balance of power within the Middle East?
Sure. I think there's a lot of things to worry about. What I don't think they would do is go off and like launch a nuclear weapon and sort of bolt out of the blue. Like they're not crazy. You know, they have ideology, but they're not insane and they care about, you know, self-preservation, and if they launched a nuclear weapon, I think that'd be the end of them. So they understand that. But what I do think you'd see is a few things in terms of dangers. One, other countries in the region potentially responding. Saudi Arabia, most notably, maybe Turkey, maybe Egypt over time. And so additional nuclear proliferation in a region that's already the most unstable and violent in the world. Mm-hmm. So you don't want extra nuclear weapons rolling around in a situation like that, like higher degree of miscalculation. The Israeli-Iranian nuclear balance, because Israel doesn't have a declared program, but most analysts believe that Israel has a couple hundred nuclear weapons. And Iran and Israel do not communicate at all, are very geographically close to each other. You know, both would have small arsenals that are vulnerable. Those are all factors that could lead to miscalculation, you know, especially if, let's say, you had a war in Lebanon with Hezbollah and you had some kind of confrontation, you could see that leading to potential nuclear exchange. And also, I think all the things Iran already does in the region, support for Hezbollah, support for Assad, Iraqi Shia militias. Now imagine all that if there also was able to provide some nuclear reassurance and umbrella to those groups, it would be able to push much further. So mm-hmm. I think all those things raise concerns.
All right, a lot of people, just to bring it back home for a moment, a lot of people are aware that former National Security Advisor John Bolton took a really hawkish position on Iran, did not trust Iran. What do we know about the views of his successor, Robert O'Brien, and the influence O'Brien has on President Trump's thinking?
We don't know that much. I mean, O'Brien is not a career foreign policy guy. He was interestingly instrumental. You know, he used to be the hostage negotiator at the State Department, and just months after, you know, he came into his position, we had the Iran, you know, an exchange of an Iranian hostage for an American being held in Iran, an academic, and so that was sort of driven by O'Brien. You know, but the real players in the administration on this, Mike Pompeo seems to really dominate. And he and Mark Esper, the Secretary of, you know, Defense, are somewhat on the same page, it sounds like. And also Vice President Mike Pence has taken a hard line. And Pompeo in particular has a long history of taking a hard line on Iran from his time in Congress. He really views it as the sort of focal point in the Middle East. And he is probably at this point the most powerful member of President Trump's cabinet, and by all accounts was one of the key drivers behind the decision to kill Soleimani.
Is Pompeo unafraid of a war with Iran?
I think, yeah. I don't think he is. I think he thinks the Iranians either wouldn't dare do it, or he thinks that at the end of the day, like, we would come out better on the other end, you know, and I question that. I mean, look, I do think we have to remember, Iran is not 10 feet tall. If the U.S. and Iran got into a conflict, you know, things would be worse for Iran than the United States. But it would be very ugly for the United States. I mean, Iran can inflict damage on us. It can, you know, launch a lot of missiles at bases in the Gulf. It can launch terrorist attacks. It can activate Hezbollah to attack Israel with missiles and bring Israel into a war and create a situation in Lebanon. It can drop mines into the Persian Gulf and potentially for a while close the Strait of Hormuz, which would cause chaos for at least a number of weeks, you know, with global oil prices. So Pompeo, I think, seems to undersell all these possibilities and seems to think that somehow maximum pressure we can get Iran to essentially surrender on all of its objectives and give in completely, which is, I just don't think, a viable strategy.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. William is on the line in Wimberley, Texas. Hi, William.
Hi. Glad to show. My question is really about the election. To me, everything is about the election. I think that, you know, this is another strategy by Donald Trump and his cronies. That's also... See if we can detract any interest in the ongoing impeachment saga. So I'm just wondering what you think about that.
All right. Thank you for your call, William. It was a little hard to hear him based on the connection, but he was asking questions about how the current situation and the tension with Iran might play into President Trump's political strategy with regard to the upcoming 2020 presidential elections.
Yeah. So, look, I think it's interesting because the initial, you know, you'd think usually in these situations you have a rally around the flag effect and it helps the president. But actually, you had some polling out today from USA Today and I think yesterday from Reuters that had this as a very unpopular move, generally speaking. I think it was something like 34% support, 52% oppose because of concerns over, or at least concerns that what Trump did is actually, like, at least his handling of Iran, 34-52 was the number I saw today, negative. And I think it's because of anxiety that this could really lead to another war in the Middle East. And so if he was calculating, and I don't know if he was calculating that this was going to help his reelection or change the discussion from impeachment, it has changed the discussion from impeachment somewhat for a few days, but I don't think it's really going to help him that much. My hope is now it kind of recedes into the background. I mean, if Iran is still a major issue driving the debate, you know, in a few months from now, that's really tilting the balance on the election, it means something has gone horribly wrong. And this escalation we saw yesterday was just the beginning of something much uglier, because my hope is we can all de-escalate now and have at least some calm for a while.
All right. Next on the line is Kathleen in Austin, Texas. Hi, Kathleen. Kathleen, are you with us? Hi.
Yes. My question is this. Does the president have among his advisors assuming he's taking advice, any experts on Iran in particular and the Middle East in general?
Thanks for calling.
Anyone who really knows their culture and country and history?
Well, there are certainly people at the State Department, the Pentagon, and the intelligence community who understand the Middle East very well and understand Iran very well. The question is the president hearing from them or is he reading their material? You know, by all news reports, not very much. And so the people who are right around him, I think, understand the issue less. And what it sounds like happened, at least in the case of, you know, the decision to strike at Soleimani was, from reports, was, you know, there were a series of options prepared for the president, and that included the most extreme option being to, you know, kill Soleimani. He did not take that option initially after some initial strikes, that the U.S. conducted, instead opting to conduct some initial strikes on Shia militia groups in Iraq. But then after the protests at the embassy and the breaking into the American embassy, that's when he called his team back in and asked them to pursue this very extreme step. And also by reports, some reports at least, that PowerPoint option was put on, that option was put at the end of a PowerPoint slide as the most extreme option, which is sort of a classic, you know, ploy as a U.S. government official. And I used to work at the Pentagon for a number of years in Iran. Like, sometimes you do that. You put, you know, very extreme options on both ends. You know, you have three options, absolute surrender, total war, and what I want you to do. But you shouldn't be doing that with the president. I think that this was a mistake. In my time, we would not have done this under President Obama. Any option that you give to the president of the United States has to be a viable one that you would hope that they might be willing to take.
Ilan Goldenberg is senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We'll continue our discussion about the U.S., Iran, and what comes next. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ilan Goldenberg, who is senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We're talking this hour about the U.S., Iran, and what comes next. So, Ilan, if I understand this correctly, from Iraq's perspective, the drone strike on Soleimani on Iraqi soil was a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. There's been talk in Iraq of expelling U.S. forces from their borders once and for all. How consequential was that vote in the Iraqi parliament to do just that?
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear exactly how consequential it was. You still have a whole process before the U.S. is actually pushed out. First of all, because you have an Iraqi caretaker government right now, the prime minister has actually resigned. So that because of protests in the city, in the country. And so you'd have to have a new government formed and a whole bunch of steps taken. But I think it is important because, you know, fundamentally, before this moment, you had major protests going on inside of Iraq. There were actually protests really targeting corruption and sectarianism and really also partially targeting Iranian interference. And this attack has kind of turned the table on the United States when it was Iran who was in a much weaker position beforehand in Iraq. We had an opportunity, I think, to help move the country in a better direction. Now we're seen as being just as big of a problem. I mean, I was actually in Iraq about a month ago, and the sense I had from people was, we are sick of, we just want our own country back. Mm-hmm. We don't want the Americans meddling in our space. We don't want the Iranians meddling in our space. And worst of all, we don't want to be the chessboard on which the U.S. and Iran, like, fight out their fights. And now we've created a situation which is almost our worst nightmare, which is why they're pushing back so hard on us.
The fact that the Iranians reportedly warned Iraqi officials in advance of their strikes on those U.S. military targets in Iraq, is that a signal that Iran is saying, look, our beef is not with you, Iraq, at the moment, it is with the U.S.?
Yes, I think partially, but it's also was a way of making sure Americans weren't killed. Because uh-huh. by uh-huh. telling the because you had Americans and Iraqi security officials, you know, or forces co-located. So if you're the Iraqis and you find this out from the Iranians, you're going to tell the Americans also. You have no choice. Pretty awkward. Hey, guys, let's get all the Iraqis off the base. But Americans, we don't know what's going on here. I mean, that's not how it works. We're partners and allies. I think the Iranians were very well aware that if they told the Iraqis, it would get back to us. I mean, it sounds like there are other ways it got back to us, too, including intelligence and other channels of communication. But the Iranians right now are actually telling their militia forces to restrain themselves as much as possible in responding to the U.S. and Iraq, and I think they're doing it because they want to isolate us politically and try to get us kicked out of the country.
Help me understand the relationship between the president and the supreme leader of Iran and the Iranian-backed militias we hear about operating elsewhere in the region. How much control does Tehran have over those groups?
Right. So it's the Quds Force, actually, and Qasem Soleimani, who's was the point man on those relationships. And each one is different, right? Iran pursues a strategy generally of they can't fight us on the battlefield directly, like overwhelming force. I think they know they'd lose. And so they support these different Shia militia groups, they're basically terrorist groups in some cases, as ways of increasing their influence. Part of it is political. Part of it is military. They provide arms. They provide weapons. They provide training. And, you know, take their gold standard is Hezbollah in Lebanon, which they set up in the early 80s after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and during the early years of the Islamic Revolution. And there, the ties are incredibly strong. Iran has trained a lot of these fighters and basically created a military, an alternative military inside the state, a state within the state, and also now provides them with very sophisticated missiles. Now, Hezbollah is mostly beholden to Iran, but it also has its own domestic politics in Lebanon, so it's going to strategize. For example, if Iran were to say to Hezbollah now, hey, you must respond by attacking Israel with missiles, Hezbollah would probably try to talk the Iranians out of it, because that would be very bad for Hezbollah's interests inside of Lebanon, and they don't really want a full war with Israel, but they'll find ways to help Iran conduct terrorist attacks. Elsewhere in Iraq, these militia groups were set up by Iran after 2003. Kitab Hezbollah, which was a group in particular launching these missiles, very much a direct link to Iran and very much beholden to Iran, but again, also factor in their own Iraqi domestic politics. But then you have other examples, like the Houthis in Yemen, which Iran has supported, where the relationship is much looser, or Hamas, which doesn't really have much of a relationship with Iran anymore in you know, the Palestinian territories. And so, you know, for each relationship, it depends on the history. It depends on how much Iran trusts them. It depends on how effective they are. But there's all different levels.
So it appears that neither Iran nor the U.S. actively wishes for a war despite recent tensions. But it is also clear that we're not out of the woods yet. So What kinds of actions, mistaken or intentional, might cause that war to happen anyway?
Well, I think Iran is going to look for another way to retaliate. And if they are too successful, they might inadvertently trigger a conflict. So I can see something like, an assassination of a senior American official would, if it was very clear it was from Iran, could trigger a major escalation. You could also have, or a terrorist attack on an American embassy, something like that. You could also have an accident. I mean, it sounds like now there's increasing reporting, for example, that, this passenger plane, that's an Iranian passenger is going to Ukraine that was shot down, that went down a couple of days ago, the day of the missile strike. Sounds like it was inadvertently shot down by Iran. People must have, I don't know yet, but sort of seemed like that would be the case day of. I mean, you know, Iranians probably should have closed their airspace, not had any planes taking off at that time. That would have been, I think, the smarter, more responsible move. But, that's an example of a miscalculation. Let's say somebody takes out the wrong plane, sees something that's different in this moment of tension, some kind of incident where our Navy and their Navy get into it because they're all in close proximity, something could explode. All these miscalculations are possible, or misreading of each other's red lines.
So if this Ukrainian airliner turns out to have been mistakenly shot down by the Iranians, just help me understand why they would have shot down a very large plane within their own airspace.
So I think what would have happened was, they knew the attacks were coming. They fired off missiles at us.
Uh-huh.
They're sitting there waiting for, is there going to be an American retaliation? They don't really know. Everyone is on high alert. Somebody misreads something on a, on radar and thinks that, this passenger plane is actually an American missile or a plane coming in to attack, God knows what, and shoots it down inadvertently. Like, that's my theory. You'd have to wait and see. But that's exactly the type of thing we have to remember. I mean, all this is triggered. So I think the fault in that lies on Iran, in that they should have, if they were going to launch these missiles, they should have just closed the airspace for the entire country for a while, or after. But it also, it goes back to, we decided to strike at Soleimani and triggered all these things. And now we have an accident that, has killed more than 100 people, including, I believe it's 30 Canadian citizens. I have to look at the numbers again. It might be 60, I think. But, you know, a large number of Canadian citizens and students who are going back to Canada, Iranian Canadian citizens, and all a result of, you know, irresponsible, you know, decisions to escalate. So it's just a reminder that even though we avoided a war, there are a lot of casualties that come from things like that, and mistakes that happen in the middle of a conflict.
All right, let's go back to the phones, this time to Michael calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Michael.
Hi. My question is, how are U.S. citizens meant to form an opinion on President Trump's decision to strike General Soleimani without understanding the so-called top secret information or intelligence that could have represented an imminent threat to the U.S., or are we meant to understand the strike as a retaliatory strike in consequence to Iran's attack of the U.S. embassy in Iraq? In Iraq.
Thanks for calling.
So, you know, the administration has made both points. They've claimed, you know, Secretary Pompeo has claimed that there was an imminent threat, that there was planning being done. And when he's pushed on it, then he says, well, you know, just look at the one Iraqi, the American who was killed in the previous attack, and look at what happened at the embassy, which is one's retaliatory, one's imminent threat. So those two are different things. But I personally take it back further, and I say, you know, forget about the immediate what happened around that moment. We should have never gotten to that moment, in my opinion. We wouldn't have gotten to that moment if we didn't begin by pulling out of the nuclear deal and pursuing what's called, you know, what the Trump administration calls the maximum pressure campaign, which ultimately led to this escalation and eventual conflict. And the reality is, you know, even yesterday, the president managed to, you know, de-escalate or respond to Iran's, you know, I think relatively measured response by taking it and not escalating further. He still isn't clear about what his objectives are or what it is he wants to do. I mean, it sounds like he wants to go back into a nuclear deal of some sort and a new negotiation. But this does not help him get there in any way whatsoever. So if you don't, until he articulates a strategy and how he's actually going to do it, any way you try to evaluate the strike, whether it's the proximate, immediate, or the much longer term strategic, it just doesn't make sense.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Okay, so a number of world leaders, of course, people in Europe, but also the likes of Putin and Erdogan are urging de-escalation at this moment. What countries might be best suited to function as intermediaries in talks between the U.S. and Iran at this point?
It's tough because, you know, Oman, as I said before, earlier in the show, might have been our best option, but the Sultan, because he can actually, the Sultan Qaboos was able to reach into the IRGC and Khamenei directly, but he is quite sick, and so not really much of an option. Mm-hmm. The Qataris have decent relations with Iran. They're a possibility. Sometimes the Iraqis can be useful, but their situation is so loaded now because this happened in Iran that makes them less of a useful intermediary. In the past, the Trump administration has tried some of the different European members, different states like the French and Macron. But the problem is they can reach into the foreign ministry, but they can't really reach into the security state, the IRGC and the supreme leader, which is really what you need right now. So unfortunately, like, they are not great options. I mean, this is one of the things that's really too bad. During the Obama administration, for the first time in 40 years, you actually had a direct channel of communication between Secretary of State John Kerry and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. And so you can cut through all these things. But that no longer really exists.
What does all of this mean, including the potential for an all-out withdrawal from Iraq by U.S. troops, mean for ISIS and its potential for resurgence in the region?
So I think this is a great opportunity for ISIS in two ways. The first is that, you know, U.S. forces in Iraq, I'm not a supporter of keeping U.S. forces in Iraq indefinitely, but a small number of forces, special operators, continuing to train and assist Iraqi security forces, I think would be useful for at least a while to help continue to quell the situation in Iraq and prevent ISIS from coming back. Second, ISIS really thrives in conflict environments. And so if things really escalate between the United States and Shia militia groups, and nobody's targeting ISIS, the big winner there is ISIS that can use those opportunities to grow. And In fact, the U.S. And the counter-ISIS coalition announced that it was suspending counter-ISIS operations soon after the Soleimani strike. And the third is, you know, if we leave and aren't able to provide just some of the basic security that's provided to keep, you know, basically create an environment where diplomats and aid workers and others can do the serious work that needs to be done on the ground to actually start rebuilding the country so that you don't have a resurgence of ISIS, then that's going to also make things worse. We need to be doing stabilization and reconstruction in Iraq. That's the long-term solution for ensuring ISIS does not come back.
If de-escalation fails, how significant is the risk of an Iranian-backed attack on the U.S. homeland?
So I don't think that significant, not because they wouldn't necessarily try, but because like they're not necessarily all that capable and their networks aren't that good here. They did, if you remember, in 2011, Iran tried to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Adel El-Jubeir, by, you know, through a plot to bomb a famous restaurant in Washington, D.C. But that plot was caught very early on, and for a while, people didn't even believe it was real. It was so kind of ridiculous and poorly planned until money started showing up in a bank account of one of the operatives. You know, and what it kind of indicated, I mean, actually, in that, what the Iranians tried to do is they basically went to the Zeta cartel and tried to hire them to conduct this attack. And, you know, the Zeta cartel is one of the most heavily monitored organizations by American law enforcement. So very quickly, we caught on that this was happening. You know, and it's kind of an indicator of the fact that, you know, where the Iranians are very effective at operating in the Middle East and building out militias and having all kinds of operators to conduct those kinds of attacks, they don't have those networks here. So for them to pull something major off here in the United States, I think would be really, really hard.
Ilan Goldenberg is Senior Fellow and Director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Ilan, I feel like I understand all this much better than before we spoke. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.